PRN.
To All Together Now, this is Eleanor LeCain. Today we're talking about your drinking water. How safe is the water you drink? A new book called Troubled Water raises questions about the safety of America's drinking water, both from the tap and in bottles. The author, Seth Siegel, says we have a public health crisis based on the contaminants in our drinking water. He says chemicals in our water are linked to cancer, heart disease, obesity, hormone disruptions, and lower IQs, among other things, and that little is being done to stop it. Seth Siegel, the author of Troubled Water, is our guest today. His prior book is an award-winning international bestseller, Let There Be Water, Israel's Solution for a Water-Starved World. That book is now available in 15 foreign language editions in more than 50 countries. He's won praise from global figures such as Tony Blair, Michael Bloomberg, and Nobel Peace Prize laureate Shimon Peres. Mr. Siegel has spoken about water issues before hundreds of audiences on four continents and more than 60 U.S. cities. He's appeared in Congress, the United Nations, the World Bank, Davos, Google's headquarters, and dozens of universities, including Harvard, Yale, and Princeton. He's recognized as a thought leader and advocate on water scarcity and quality. He's a senior fellow at the University of Wisconsin Center for Water Policy, and his commentary has appeared in many leading publications, including the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post. Mr. Siegel is here with us to talk about his just-released new book, Troubled Water, What's Wrong with What We Drink? Seth Siegel, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I read your amazing book, and I'm just stunned that there's so much wrong with our water and so little being done about it, and I appreciate you writing the book to let us know about that. Let's begin with what most people would be wondering about is how safe is the water we're now drinking from our tap?
Well, to some degree, of course, it depends where it is that you live. Some places are much worse than others. But what is now pretty clear is that no matter where you live in the United States, unless you are in one of those very, very few lucky communities that has very advanced filtration and treatment, and there are very, very, very few of them, I mean, under half a dozen, you are likely to be drinking some forms of contaminants. And the graver problem is, and I hope I make this point repeatedly in my book, is that the contaminants are, we know that they're contaminants. What we don't know is the impact of them on our bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are clear. Some of them, like what's called PFOA or PFOS, which are ubiquitous. I mean, it's very widely found in water. We now know are tied to a variety of cancers and a variety of other endocrine disruptions, and that's quite serious. But what scientists told me in the research for my book is that it's not just one or two chemicals that are out there. There are many. To just make the point complete, and then I'll answer anything else, of course, about the subject, is that there are now about 125,000 chemicals that are in commerce in the United States, about 50,000 industrial solvents and chemicals, and about 75,000 pharmaceutical products, over-the-counter products, and so forth. Now, of that vast number, not all of them get into the drinking water, and not all that do clearly are necessarily a hazard, but some percentage do. And of that vast number of 125,000, it sounds almost impossible to believe, but the EPA has only regulated, which means we have to monitor them and filter them out of the water, has only regulated 70 chemicals of that vast number. So you understand that there is something amiss here. Now, even worse than that, the last time the EPA even regulated any contaminant, chemical or otherwise, is more than 20 years ago. So clearly there's a problem out there in the regulatory universe, and the implications for us in terms of what's going on with a variety of ailments that are now becoming more and more common may very well be traced back to drinking water.
Yeah, that's kind of very scary what you're laying out there. And, you know, we get some of the news about this in some dramatic cases, like we had Flint, Michigan, and the whole major problem with the entire city there when they shifted their water supply. But how common is it that there'll be some kind of a flare-up where we can trace some kind of public health hazard to our water?
You know, that's part of the problem, is that you would think that there would be an ongoing investigation exactly of the kind that your question suggests.
Mm-hmm.
And the testing methodologies and the testing frequency that the EPA has created is not only ripe, as was the case in Flint, for faking or for false positives, or more importantly, false negatives. We rarely get false positives. We do get false negatives. It creates a situation where millions and millions of people are exposed to contaminants, and some of which are known hazards, like in Flint, where we know lead is a hazard. There's no question about it, and it is regulated by the EPA. But it's far wider than any one place. It's disappointing that people think, oh, well, Flint is under control now, so everything's fine, right? And the answer is no, for sure not. This problem is widely found, and it's a problem both of science, and it's a problem also of governance.
I'll say, well, you know, I thought that the EPA required that each of the water systems do testing every year to see if the water is safe to drink. I live in Washington, D.C., and my understanding is once a year the water company here will test the water, and they always say, oh, yeah, it's fine, no problem. Is that not what happens, or are they just testing for so few of the likely contaminants out there that it's not giving us an accurate reading?
Yeah, it's the second part of your question. That's correct. And so what the EPA requires of communities is that they test for what are called the regulated contaminants, which are the 70 chemicals and about another 20 other items, radioactive items and so forth. They have to test for those different contaminants. And when they're found, then the responsibility of the utility is to reduce the concentration down to what is considered the health level. Now, the health level is almost never the level of zero.
Mm-hmm.
So the arsenic, which we know is a problem, lead, which we know is a problem, and others that we know are problems, even when found, and these are regulated items, even when they're found, the requirement is not to bring it to zero. Even though the technology exists to do so. The EPA really gives a free pass on this. The second problem is that in terms of the vast majority of other contaminants that are out there, the EPA has something called the Unregulated Contaminant Monitoring Rule, where it asks utilities of a certain size to check for those particular contaminants to see how widely found they are. But they don't ask every utility. So if you live in a small town or you're a large place like Los Angeles that has lots and lots of small water utilities, you may be at risk of getting all kinds of contaminants that are being investigated for just down the road from you. But here's the kicker. Even if the contaminant is found, the utility has no obligation to remove it or to reduce it in the drinking water because it isn't a regulated contaminant. It's just merely for research purposes only.
Well, that's kind of scary. You know, get a combination here where, first of all, the EPA is only regulating about 90 contaminants out of 125,000 or more possible contaminants. So it's a very narrow range they're testing for. And you're saying the levels that they say are acceptable are, you know, maybe higher than they should be, and if something's found that's not on their list, then the water agency has no responsibility to clean it up. Is that correct?
Everything you just said is absolutely correct. And you also don't have a momentum within the EPA to change this. They accept the status quo for all these things as an ongoing basis. You also have a situation where if you live in a small community, you are, with one exception which is not worth going into here, you are exempt from this unregulated contaminant monitoring rule that I mentioned. So you don't even have, so you could be in a factory town. I opened my book, Troubled Water, with exactly this story. There's a small town, a bucolic town, something, if some of your listeners are old enough, they'll remember the name Norman Rockwell. He used to paint these covers for a magazine that had a very idyllic kind of community look. And I found this idyllic Norman Rockwell-esque community in upstate New York, a place called Hoosick Falls. It's just a very short drive from the Vermont border. It's a beautiful place. The people are nice. It's friendly. It's a small, it's the old-fashioned small-town America. And Hoosick Falls, to some degree, actually reminded me of Bedford Falls, and It's a Wonderful Life. Just everybody caring about one another and so forth. Now, it's a factory town. And for, at least 50 years now, the primary industry of the town has been making products that have some of the chemical elements that are found in Teflon. But because it's a small community, and because the utility services under the threshold that the EPA requires, in Hoosick Falls, they were never asked to test for what is the active ingredient in Teflon. Now, lo and behold, that active ingredient is a carcinogen. That's not a theory. This is a scientific fact. It's a carcinogen. So you would think at a minimum that the EPA would say, okay, look, small communities, we don't want to burden you with having to do testing, but he will tell you what we'll do is if your town has a reason to think that it has this contaminant in its drinking water, then we will oblige you to do that. They don't do that. Now, I want to say something else, by the way, that I might have added into my last answer. And that is, you know, I said that the EPA asks large communities to test a certain number of contaminants every year. And in your summary of it, you said this is scary and that's scary and that's scary. But I'm going to tell you something else that's crazy. By congressional action, the EPA, if they wanted to, couldn't test, say, 100 or 150 or 250 or certainly not 125,000 chemicals. They're not allowed to. They're only allowed to test a couple of dozen in every three-year period. So, and they're only allowed to collect data on that. So even if the EPA wanted to do more in terms of more research, they're not even allowed to do that under a congressional action. That just doesn't simply make any sense to me. Why wouldn't you want your nation's agency charged with protecting the public health and drinking water? Why wouldn't you want them to pursue any lead that they could possibly find that might offer concern?
Right, exactly. Well, it's looking like we've got a couple of obstacles here. You know, one is we know the Environmental Protection Agency has long ago become captive of a lot of the industries that it's supposed to be monitoring, and we get executives from companies that are producing these toxins end up in major leadership roles or running the agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency or in some cases the Food and Drug Administration where Monsanto executive took over. So their job in going into those industries and that revolving door is precisely to defang the agency and make sure it doesn't really aggressively defend the interests of the American people. They're too busy defending the interests of the companies. So that's kind of a generic problem we've got throughout our government right now, and pretty much all the agencies that are supposed to be regulating tend to be captive or lapdogs to the agencies they're supposed to be regulating. But I would have thought that at a local level, people would be more concerned about protecting themselves and their families and their neighbors because so many of these water agencies are local. But you're saying that's not what's happening. In fact, the Hoosick Falls example you gave is kind of on the contrary. And what's the problem blocking at the local level? Is it that, like in Hoosick Falls, the local people know there may be some contaminants, but they'd rather not know exactly what it is or how bad it is because they want the jobs and the industry to stay in their town? Is that what's going on?
Well, look. Let me, if I can. It's a wonderfully rich question you're asking, and it has lots of elements to it. So let me, with your assistance, let me unpack the question a little bit, if I may.
Sure.
The first part is, as you talk about throughout the entire federal government, the agencies are the exact word you used was lapdogs for industry. I want to make clear that that may be the case, but I can't say that because I just want to make clear that my research was really limited to drinking water and the EPA and the FDA. So, and the FDA vis-a-vis bottled water. So my comments are really limited only to that. So I'm not taking issue with what you're saying. I'm just saying is that my research was more limited. So I don't want my silence to confirm, you know, what you're saying, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing I want to say is, and this may be more surprising to your listeners, and that is that what was shocking to me, sometimes I'm asked what's the most surprising thing I learned in my years of research to write this book, and I'll tell you what it was, is that I went into this kind of assuming that it was a tug of war, that in certain administrations you had, you know, a really tight, well-guarded drinking water regime, and then you had other administrations where all hell would break loose. You know, that was sort of what I thought. That's not even close to true. What happens is, in reality, and just again, just vis-a-vis drinking water, is it's all the same. There's more rhetorical support for activism on the Democratic administrations than Democratic Congresses. But even in those periods when we've had a Democratic president, a Democratic Senate, a Democratic House, and you could do, and a Democratic EPA, obviously, and you could do anything you wanted, nothing changes. And that's what I think is so startling. Now, under President Trump, obviously, you have more recently, you have the change of the waters of the U.S. where farmers and other people are able to dump industrial chemicals and other things into some waterways. And that obviously will have some impact ultimately on source water, which will ultimately have impact on drinking water. But that's not as significant a change as you might think from a political point of view, because that rule was only put into place late in the second term of the Obama administration. So not in the Clinton years, not in the first 6, 7, 8 years of the Obama years. It was all the same. And that's vis-a-vis the waters of the U.S. In terms of drinking water regulation, nothing changes. Nothing changes whatsoever. Now, I might pause to let you, you know, ask a follow-up question, but your question was about the locality, and if you want, I can jump into that now. But I do want to just say that you know, that at the premise of this as well is that you think that, you know, that maybe in some types, you know, we vote, we're all, you know, everyone on this listening to the show, I'm sure, is an activist citizen, and we care very much, and, you know, I'm a passionate voter, you know, I vote even in small off-year elections, because I think it's one of the great privileges I have. But you know, there is a critique that it doesn't make a difference. And in drinking water, unfortunately, that's been more proven true than not.
Yeah, well, there's some concern by American citizens, even though this issue of safe drinking water has not really broken through into a top-tier issue. Flint certainly did break through. And people are kind of a little bit nervous anyway, and the bottled water industry has been fanning the flames of fears about our drinking water to get us to shift from the tap water into the bottled water. But you say that people who think that drinking bottled water is safer than tap water are wrong. And why are they wrong?
Well, what my critique of the bottled water system is that, and if you look, and I did do this, if you look by the year-by-year growth of the industry, what you understand is what it really does is it tracks simultaneously people's greater concerns about drinking water safety, about tap water safety. And so what has happened here is that we have created in the United States a a parallel alternative drinking water system, which is by which Americans, really of all classes, all geographies, have defaulted now to a new drinking water system, and that is bottled water. And the numbers are just daunting. You would think, well, how big could it possibly be, right? Well, first of all, just in terms of the dollar numbers, the wholesale numbers, which is to say probably half to a third of the actual number, is about $18.5 to $19 billion a year. That's a big number starting with that. And how many containers are we talking about? We're talking about 70 billion, with a B, 70 billion drinking water packages sold a year. Now, lots and lots and lots has been written about the pollution, about the solid waste problem that it creates, the oceanic plastic that it's created. But what's less written about is what is going on inside the bottle. And so I was curious, and I decided, yes, of course, like everybody else, I'm concerned about the buildup of trash and solid waste. But I was curious to know is, well, what about the water itself? And what we discovered is that that the water inside the drinking water bottle is not exactly as clean or as pure as you would think it would be. And so, for example, the NRDC, which is a wonderful not-for-profit organization focused on a variety of environmental issues and clearly very focused on drinking water, a bunch of years ago did a test of, they picked 100 brands and they did 3 bottles of each of them. And they found that more than half of the brands had at least one of those 3 bottles had contaminants that were above federal guideline levels, but that almost all of them had some contaminants in them. So that's something that you should be thinking about, number one. Number two is, so the source water itself may have a problem. Number two is, the plastic is not, if it's a plastic bottle, it's not benign. If it's a stable material like metal, which isn't treated with BPA or BPS, and if it's glass, which also doesn't have a plastic liner, which a lot of bottles do and people don't realize, then you're okay more or less. But if it's a plastic bottle and the water is filled and then shipped or stored in a hot place, then there's a cooking that goes on. It doesn't have to boil, it just has to be warm. And the water starts to get cooked adjacent to the plastic, and the plastic begins leaching a variety of chemicals into the water. And some of those chemicals, like phthalates, have been tied directly to a whole variety of birth defects and other endocrine disruptions, changes in genital size and shape, lower IQs, social integration problems in newborns, and when they grow, it grows worse. So there's really a large number of concerns that a legitimate person could have about their bottled water. And then one last thing I'll say about bottled water, which is, and this will shock, I think, almost everybody, and that is that a large amount of bottled water is under no federal regulation whatsoever, not EPA, not FDA, not nothing, because there's a loophole in our regulatory regime that says that if a bottle is filled and sold in the same state, it's not subject to any federal oversight. And since most states don't have any or very lax bottled water oversight, it means that, you know, it's basically do what you want. You could fill it with tap water and sell it to your cousin's convenience store down the street.
Right, and I think that's a shock to most people that at least with the tap water, there's some regulation and there is an annual testing, and it's not comprehensive, but there are some contaminants that are tested for, and you have some oversight. But once you move into most of the bottled water, there is no oversight. They could be filling it with, you know, contaminated waters next to a plant or something, and you wouldn't know it, and they wouldn't be liable for any problem because they're not breaking any law. So to all my friends out there who drink out of bottled water thinking it's safer than tap water, just think about what you just said. There is no federal regulation for most of that bottled water. And you know, there's the power of the bottled water industry, which you mentioned the number of 70 billion containers a year. It's also, you talk about the amount of money they make. In the annual wholesale sales, you talk about $18.5 billion in that industry, and most of it not regulated. So plus there's the disposal problem, as you mentioned, with all those bottles. So you know, as challenging as our tap water can be, we shouldn't be rushing to the bottled water as our savior here. Really what we need to do is make sure that our tap water is more safe. So,
By the way, I really want to thank you for that last comment. That's exactly why I wrote the book. I'm a community activist type personality. I mean, I've been involved in activism my entire adult life, and when I had the good fortune almost 20 years ago of being able to sell a business that I co-created, I decided to spend the rest of my life in one form or another of communal service. I sort of accidentally, in your very kind and generous introduction, you mentioned my prior book, Let There Be Water, and I wrote that book as a response to an understanding that there was a complete gap in federal policy and UN policy on trying to fix water scarcity issues around the world to head off what's going to be really large refugee flows, and I don't believe enough is being done. And I gave a model on how to fix that. Now, some countries are actually doing a lot, and I've been welcomed very warmly in around the world to meet heads of state and environment ministers and speak in parliaments around the world, and that's been wonderful, but I still feel that things are moving too slowly. That book led me to start thinking about, not about water scarcity, but water quality. And, mm-hmm. and the sense that I got, Eleanor, which is so interesting, is that the more I read, and I'm not some sort of person who's easily inflamed. I mean, mm-hmm. I kind of like assume things are more or less operating pretty well and everything's okay. The more I read, the more agitated I got. The more I learned, the more agitated I got. Because what I saw is that at all levels, the federal level, at the state level, at the locality, which you asked me before about, and I got off track and I didn't get to answer. But at all these places, you have a similar problem where we're using old technology. We're not mandating a replacement of technology to adapt to the new current threats that we have. And the effect of all this that we're coming to see clearer and clearer is having an impact on the national health and national well-being. And it's just, to my mind, totally unacceptable. I wrote this book, and by the way, I give 100% of the royalties from my last book and this book are given to charity. So I didn't do any of this to make money. I'm doing this because I am just outraged over how what a state we are in now in terms of our drinking water and the fact that it's so easy to fix, and I don't understand why we're not doing more about it. And I think the reason is that politicians of both parties have the attitude of that if nobody's calling them and yelling about it, they really don't care. And my goal with writing this book is, yes, I'd love to sell a book to every American. But the truth of the matter is, my goal is that people will learn these issues, internalize these issues, and then this will become part of the discourse in society. And once people start calling their congressmen and their mayors and their governors and their local representatives, once they start getting those phone calls, you can be sure elected officials will respond very, very quickly, because that's historically exactly what happens. Every time there's been a new piece of water legislation, it's been in response to a sudden awareness that public health is being threatened. People call and scream, and politicians get very smart and smart on the issues, and they pass the needed legislation, they demand the needed regulation, and then, lo and behold, for a period of time, things are better. Now, we are now in a period of more than 20 years of complete inactivity, and I am really hoping, I don't need a revolution, but I really am hoping to provoke a big national conversation, and that my win will not be to sell, a million books, but my win will be that 2 or 3 years from now, everybody is fighting all over themselves in legislatures, state and federal, how to fix this, and every water utility around the country is looking over their shoulder and understanding that they better get their act together, otherwise that they're going to have some consequences for not doing so.
Yeah, that's great. And the very effect of your own situation where you say the more you learned about the conditions of our drinking water, the more agitated you got. And I certainly felt that in reading the book. I thought I knew a fair amount. I mean, I knew about the medicines that end up leaking into our water and then making the antibiotics less effective and various things like that. But I was not aware of the full scope and scale of the problem we're facing. And you just mentioned several key things that I'd like to dive into a little bit more here, because they're fascinating and absolutely critical for our public health. One that you mentioned is that we're using old technology. You talk in the book about how our water systems were built like 100 years ago, and they're leaking water, and they're starting to break. Can you describe for our listeners, like, how old are our water systems? When were they built? And what's the problem now with leakage and breaking?
Yeah, so America's drinking water infrastructure grew up in three great periods. Call the first one about 1880. The second one was, say, basically the 1920s up until around about the Great Depression in October 1929. And the third one was immediately in the post-World War era, but not like 1946, more or less, starting around 1948, 49, 50, and running then through the early 1970s. And so here's the crazy thing. Each of those three periods used different pipes, different kind of pipes to convey water. And in the unbelievably bad luck, each of them has a useful life that all terminates right around now. So we have 1.1 million miles of what's called water mains, and I'll have to explain to your listeners something that most people won't know and understand. Water mains are these relatively fat pipes. You know, it could be as little as 2 or 4 inches if it's a very small community, but it's usually much more than that. It could be these fat pipes that convey water from the central distribution point throughout the city or locality or community. And then branching off of those are something called service lines. Those branch into buildings and homes and schools and churches and so forth. And so, but the water mains alone are the ones that were built in those three periods primarily, and they last, as I said, until just about today. So we're starting to see a large number of leaks. We lose now about a third of all of the water we clean and transport right now to leaks. Last year, there were 240,000 throughout the United States, 240,000 water main breaks. But that's not where all the water gets lost. A lot of water gets lost just in cracks and leaks that are in the system because the system is old and not very smart and doesn't have a lot of diagnostics to fix it. Now, to a large degree, I get asked by audiences, where does all this mean about climate change? What has the connections? And there are a few. But I'd like to just make one connection right now for you. And that is that we spend a gigantic amount of carbon fuel in the process of transporting water, cleaning water, and heating water. In fact, about 18% of the total electricity used last year in the state of California was used on that for water. And then if you figure that about a third of all of the water is lost through leaks, what you understand is, now not every state is the same, but in California where water is transported long distances, it certainly is true, that if 18% of all the electricity used in California, a vast state with lots of refrigerators and air conditioners and computers, 18% is used just to do that for water, and then a third of that is lost, it means that about 6% of all carbon fuel usage, again, I'm rounding it up a little bit because obviously some of it is solar, some of it is wind power, but some very vast amount of carbon fuels are burned and then used and then lost and wasted. And it's sort of like, you know, turning on the air conditioner in your house on the coldest possible temperature and then going away on a four-month vacation. It just doesn't make any sense. And why wouldn't we go about fixing the water mains? And we're not going to have a lot of choice pretty soon, because if we're breaking at the rate of 240,000 a year and that rate is accelerating about 10-12% a year, it's getting worse, pretty soon we're going to have to replace all of our water mains. And one of the arguments I make is that we are just not ready for it. It's going to cost us a great deal of money. We haven't planned for it. We don't have a financial model to pay for it, mostly. Some big cities do, but mostly don't. And in the smaller communities, they're going to get whacked. They just don't have the money. And what they're doing, like, for example, in the suburbs of Chicago, there are a whole bunch of Chicago suburbs that are now losing water between 40 and 45% of their total water flow. And they just let it leak. Because the alternative is to have to change the infrastructure. And I think that this lack of planning and lack of leadership out of Washington and certainly out of the EPA is something that is just ripe for national conversation.
Right, exactly. And I think what I hear you say is it's not really about fixing the water mains, that they're all now old enough, we probably need to replace pretty much all of them. Would you agree?
Well, look, I mean, the dream of every water main is that you replace it the day before it cracks and it's not repairable.
Right.
You know, so, and it's hard to time all that today because we don't have the technology embedded in the pipes to tell us, you know, when leaks are happening. There are pipes that exist that you can do that with, and I make the argument that as pipes get replaced, we should do the next generation a favor and put smart pipes in place. I mean, so that would be a smart thing to do. And we don't have to replace everything today because there is still plenty of juice left in many of them. But within the next 20 years, it's pretty clear that just about the entire national drinking water grid is going to have to be replaced. And I'd make the argument that we're already about 10 years late in getting started on that process. So we should be thinking about how we're going to finance this. We should be thinking about, especially in poorer communities and smaller communities and rural communities, we should be thinking about how we're going to get that done. And we should be thinking about what kind of technology we want to use with the replacement pipes, because what ends up happening, and this is true in life as well as in infrastructure, is that when you respond to an emergency, you do two things. First is you end up spending more than you would if you'd done it in a planned way. And second of all, you're rushed into a decision. And I think that the smarter approach here is like, let's take a deep breath and say, okay, what is the kind of pipes that we want and don't want? And how do we want to get this done? If I can actually just opine on one thing for a moment, which is a real bugaboo of mine, and that is a lot of developers, real estate developers, are now deciding to save money in a way that the public doesn't know the difference, and the EPA is not making a fuss. And that is that lots of developers are now using PVC, which is a kind of plastic, PVC pipes, as water pipes, drinking water pipes. And I am very agitated about this because of the fact that the EPA has not mandated, in my view, nearly enough testing for us to be sure about the fact that these pipes are safe, number one. And number two is we already know from what happened in Paradise, California, if there's a wildfire, these pipes they're not metal. And what does plastic do when it's around heat? They melt. And the chemicals that are baked into the plastic completely pollute the water supply. It turns drinking water into toxic substance. So not only do you not have pipes available to fight the fires and to rebuild the community, but you've now managed to make sure that the community is going to have all of its water pumped in because you can't remediate that water, or at least not without enormous cost and over time. So I am very, very agitated about the fact that we just, I know it's a boring subject and like people want to yawn like, oh, do I have to talk about pipes? You know, it's like, but the answer is it has such a profound impact on the health and well-being and the finances of our country that it's amazing to me that we just aren't having this conversation anywhere. You couldn't find a single article about this topic if you searched the 20 top newspapers in America. You know, it's just not a subject that people talk about. You know,
I think this is one of those sleeper issues, which is absolutely vital, and it's like a disaster in slow motion happening, so it doesn't hit the front page of the paper, or even page 20. But really, the saying is, water is life. And, you know, we could live 40 days or more without food, but we can't live that long without water. And it's something we need to drink and want to drink. Every day, it's good for kind of clearing out the toxins in our body as long as it's clear water. So what does health work to us? You know, what is good quality water that will help us have good quality public health? What is that worth? I think it's just really critical. And I was excited to learn in your book that there is actually new technology that we could use to replace the old worn-out pipes that can do things like monitor leaks better and identify contaminants better. So talk to us a little bit about what we could be installing in our water systems now that would be even better than what we've got now.
So I'm glad to do that. Thank you for that question. I will tell you something. If I can frame the question, though, before I give a precise answer, is I defy your listeners. If your listeners are getting agitated and annoyed, I want you to get even more annoyed because I defy you to find another even minor category that has such an antipathy towards technological innovation and change. I mean, imagine 120 years ago, whatever tools of war we were using then, what of those are we using today? None. What tools of 120 years ago or 100 years ago are we using in communication that's the same? None. What about office machines? None. Well, I mean, what about hospitals? Virtually none. I mean, maybe tongue depressors, and that's about it. You know, it's in category after category after category. Everything has changed. The classroom has changed. The university has changed. The workplace has changed. And yet we're still using the same wastewater and drinking water facility infrastructure that we did 50, 75, 100, 120 years ago. And it just doesn't make any sense to me. So this is so that now, especially, you know, in every other part of the world, every couple of years, there's some great innovation and we're doing something special and new. And this is capable of being done in water also. But you know what happens? The big water technology companies get frustrated. They come out with these great ideas and there's no customer for it. So innovators say, you know what? I can put my energy somewhere else, and I will, and I will. But you have pipes that can tell you when there's a leak anywhere in there. There's pipes that can tell you when there's a crack coming. There are pipes that have the capacity, as you mentioned in the intro to the question, that can tell you if there is a contaminant in the water. It can tell you, again, I won't get too technical, but something called turbidity, which is a problem of cloudiness in the water, which generally bespeaks a contaminant of some kind. And so, and even more amazing than this, you could do it in a way that doesn't cost a single penny of new energy. Because, I mean, if you could imagine a mighty turbine, rolling in a river, well, there are turbines that are about 1 inch wide that can be embedded in pipes, and they turn, and they produce electricity exactly as the giant turbine in a river does. And those, and yeah, it's not just one little tiny turbine; it's a whole series of them in the pipes. And those turbines produce enough electricity. Talk about renewable fuel; they produce renewable energy, rather. It produces enough energy that it can run all the monitoring systems of the drinking water lines. It can do all these things I mentioned before, all these monitoring and all this testing, and send all the signals and run the sort of the cellular communications that are needed, and not require even any at all energy source.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. So it's good to have a national conversation. So first of all, wake people up that we need to rebuild our water systems. And secondly, when we do it in a smart way, like not with these PVC pipes that are going to be melting as we get more fires from global climate change and so forth, but some of these better technology pipes that can identify leaks and maybe screen out contaminants and tell us when the system is about to break down. So, you know, we can have all these feedback systems now that weren't available. It's kind of like, if you think, you know, some of our water mains and our water systems were built, you said the first era was in the 1880s and then the 1920s. Well, in the 1880s and even somewhat in the 1920s, people were getting around pretty much by, you know, bicycles. And by the 1920s, cars were starting to come in, but they weren't by any means common. But it would be like if some people talked about getting around just by bicycles now without cars.
Or horses and mules.
Or horses and mules. You know, instead of using cars or some of the advanced train systems we've got or some of the airplane, spaceships now, we don't have to just rely on bicycle. But when you talk about our water systems, that's essentially what we're doing. We're using water systems back with the horse, you know, time of horses and bicycles, when what we need to be doing is getting, it may not have to be spaceship level quality, but we certainly can have much better innovation and quality in our water systems now. So how do we do it? You've obviously given a lot of thought to the problems in our drinking water and what could be done with it. We're a very solution-oriented show here.
Yep.
how do we, what do we do about the problem? What can our listeners do, both in terms of their personal water, making sure that's, you know, clean, or finding out, how do we find out what's in our own water? And what can we do as citizens to move at the systemic level of making safe drinking water available to every American?
Well, first of all, your entire question was precisely the, if I had a mission statement for my book, your last question is precisely the mission statement of the book. And that is that I didn't want to just lay out a problem. I wanted to specifically lay out a series of solutions, both on what I'll call the macro or societal level and also on the personal level. Because, and to make crystal clear, I want there to be a new focus on drinking water because I know it's a solvable problem. There are so many vexing problems that we have. You know, climate change is just one of many, but there are so many vexing problems that we have in our society that are, some are scientific, some are sociological, like race relations or biases or things like that. And then we also have, we have some problems that are actually totally solvable. So I want to see, my goal is that people, yes, I would like people to read my new book, Troubled Water, so that they can understand the issues at hand. But even if you don't read the book, it's fine. Because what the book lays out is, first is the problem, and then it lays out the societal large-scale solutions, what we can do for all of us. And then I lay out sort of in a more granular level what we can do for communities that are more distressed and that are poor. Because no, this should not be something like, you know, that only rich people have quality drinking water. That would not be fair or appropriate. It should be a national right. In some countries, by the way, it's enshrined in their constitutions to have the drinking water for all. And then the final chapter of the book is sort of like the last piece, which is, okay, let's imagine you really don't care about systemic change, and you really don't care about, you know, fixing the society's water. Is what can you as an individual citizen do? And I go through a whole variety of things that you can do, from very, very cheap things to actually no cost at all things. It's just be mindful of your environment, be careful of, you know, where you choose to live. Are you within 3 miles of a chemical facility, or are you in a certain distance from a manufacturing facility? What kind of discharge do they have? You have the right to examine their EPA filings, especially if they discharge into waterways. And so that's a starting point. There are a whole bunch of tests that you can do inexpensively. There are some that you can do, but very expensively, to find out what's in your drinking water. And then you can buy different filters that can protect it, you know, that are made by some of the big water filtration companies that provide household products. You can buy at the local hardware store or mass merchandiser. But you don't want to just buy for example, if you don't have no lead in your water, buying a lead filter, it makes no sense. Whereas if you live in a farming community and there may be nitrates or pesticides in your water and you have a lead filter, that's not going to do anything for you either. So it's not like one filter fits all. You need to have a filter that filters out the problem that you have. And I lay that out in my book as well. And then finally, if you are a rich person and you really don't give a damn about, you know, fixing it for everybody else, the simple solution is close your eyes, write a check, and have a reverse osmosis system installed in your home, and you'll be just fine. But that's not what I'm calling for. And I will tell you, frankly, I reject that personally. I'm not prepared personally to install. I could afford to do so, but I have no interest in segregating myself and putting myself in some, you know, ivory tower kind of situation where I'm exempt from everything else. I want everybody to think that this is something that's urgent to be done, and that we can demand it of our elected officials, and once we do that, we will get the results we want.
Right, exactly. And on the personal level, I was encouraged to see that you highlight in your book champions who are out there working actively for cleaner water on behalf of all of us, and one of them, the Environmental Working Group, actually has a website you can go to, and you plug in your zip code, and it'll tell you what they know about the contaminants in the water in your area. So then, once you know what your dealing with in terms of your own particular water, then you know what kind of filtering system is best for you. Like you said, one size filter doesn't fit all, but then you know which is better. So I did it myself.
By the way, that is correct, but I just want to make clear, so yeah. I don't want to give anyone the misconception. By the way, I can't say enough good things. I profile a number of wonderful environmental organizations, and I urge people to get involved with them. Environmental Working Group is terrific, really a top-notch organization. NRDC, which is across the board on environmental issues, but does a lot of very important work in drinking water. A smaller organization called Clean Water Action, it does terrific work as well, all of those. But I do want to make clear that on the tap water database that you're referring to, that zip code-based thing on with Environmental Working Group, they themselves are frustrated and stymied, and I talk about this in my book, by the fact that the only thing that they are able to get the information on contaminants about is the very small number of EPA-regulated contaminants. They don't have any means of finding out more generally what the contaminants are in any community in America because of the fact that the EPA does not make that demand of utilities. And one of the other ways we can fix our drinking water problem is we can also try our best to consolidate our utilities. We haven't had a chance to talk about this hour, but I want to just say to your listeners something that would, I think, once again, shock people. We should probably have somewhere between, 200 and 400, 200 and 500 at the most, drinking water utilities in the country. You know, something like between one or two or three or at most five or six or eight per state. You know, so something in that vicinity of maybe 200 to 400 would make sense, maybe even a little less. But we don't have anything near that. What we have is, and this is going to, you know, if you're drinking coffee, stop for a second because you're not going to believe this. We have over 50,000 water utilities in the United States. And that means that millions and millions of Americans are serviced by a utility that is so small that they don't have the means to get cutting-edge technology. They don't have the means to hire and retain highly trained staff. And it means that it's more likely than less likely, and the statistics bear this out, that you're going to have subpar, from a health point of view, subpar drinking water in the United States. There are some 80,000 violations of the Safe Drinking Water Act registered every year, and about a little more than half of them are in communities that have small water utilities. And so therefore, consolidation of utilities is one of the very first and most urgent things we need to do to fix our drinking water systems.
Yeah, I hear you on that, and then at the same time, I'm concerned when I hear the CEO of Nestle saying that he wants to privatize water and have all our water systems be taken over by private enterprise so it's run more efficiently, and the more consolidated it is, in some ways, the easier it would be for Nestle's or other multinational corporations to take over our water supply. So I'm a little concerned about that side of things, too.
It's the job of government, I believe, mm-hmm. to set the rules of the road on our behalf, and whether it's privatized systems or public systems, the truth of the matter is that with either which way it is, what needs to be done is it needs to have clear rules of the road, which demands constant innovation. And so I am actually agnostic as to whether it should be private or public. And I know that may set me apart from many other people. But I'm mm-hmm. agnostic because I think the role of government in this is strong and important. And that is to say, this is what we demand of you. This is what you must do. And if you don't, you're going to pay fines and you'll have every incentive to do it right. But I'm not prepared to say that one system is a better system than another. In fact, the UK, which has better water, lower contaminants, great innovation, great technology, lower leaks. They made a decision a bunch of years ago to privatize, but to severely regulate the private companies. And that's the model, frankly, that I think is something that we should be looking at, which is I don't care if it's public or private. That's why I said I'm agnostic as to it. I think both make a good argument as to why they're better. But I absolutely think that there's a strong role for government. And what we have now is we have government that lets the system run itself. It's basically an honor system run amok.
Well, that could be a subject for another whole conversation. I understand what you're saying, but I'm more concerned about the influence of the private corporations on our government. And too often, our U.S. government has been a handmaiden to the corporations, as we're seeing in the supposed regulation of the contaminants in our water and so forth. But let's reserve that debate for another day. But we just have 2 minutes left here, and I'd like to ask you before we sign off, if you were advising the next president of the United States on what to do about safe drinking water, what are the top three things you'd ask the president to do?
Okay, so the first thing is, and most important, is I would suggest that we either rethink water at the EPA, or, as I say in my book, I think it's time to give consideration to moving drinking water out of the EPA and into the Department of Health and Human Services. I make the argument in my book that it was probably a historic mistake in 1974 to put it into the EPA, and I time doesn't permit to explain why that happened, but I understand why it happened. Congress was maybe a bit optimistic, maybe a bit lazy, but they made a decision to do it that way. And the first thing is to do that. Second thing is that this is a category that is wildly under-researched. There is enormous need for far more research on drinking water contaminants and the conveyances of drinking water. So that means our pipes, that means our PVC pipes and so forth. So we need to know once and for all what's in our water, and we need to take away the limitations on what can be tested. And there's a number of other things that I lay these all out in my book as well. There's another thing that I would do is some 40 million Americans, largely in rural America, that get their drinking water from drinking water wells, private wells. And the EPA, by regulation, is not permitted to have any involvement with them. And on every test that is done, it reveals that about half or more of these are grossly contaminated with E. coli, with gasoline, with nitrates, and other products like that, that are causing all kinds of problems, for health problems for people in rural America. And these are tends to be poor people. These tend to be people without political access or clout. And I think that this is another thing that really requires an administration to focus on in a big way. And then the final thing that I would suggest, if only given the power to do three, four, five things, is I would say it's time finally for us to make a national effort to replace all of the lead service lines in our country. There are as many as 10.5 million of them. We will not be able to replace them all in 2 or 3 or 5 years. But I lay out in my book a plan and a means for how we can replace all of the lead service lines in the country within a single generation. And we are poisoning our children. We are creating all kinds of problems for their IQ, for their attention deficit, for their inclination towards other bad behaviors. And I think it's our job to fix this for them.
That's all the time we have. Seth Siegel, book is Trouble Waters. Thank you so much for being with us today and for all your important work.